complete short story on which this is based has been published, but I've got another 50,000 words to go, so there we go. Chapter 1. The day before my 7th birthday, my father appeared before me in the orchard. Enveloped in a thin mist, he was hovering some distance above the ground, to the left of the blighted pear tree, the crown of his Homburg hat brushing against an overhanging branch. I was so startled by this sudden manifestation that I dropped the bald grey tennis ball with which I'd been playing and allowed it to roll away from me into the compost heap. I had never met him before, but I had no doubt that this was my father. I recognised that naughty boyish smile, thin spiv moustache and lanky figure clad in a baggy demob suit from the photograph of my parents' wedding that Granny Delgardi kept face down in the left-hand drawer of the dresser. I'd often sneak to look at that picture, and the resemblance was unmistakable, even if his face did seem unnaturally pallid. And there was a translucent shimmering around the edges of his person which might have unnerved a slightly more sensitive child than my detached, pragmatic self. "Had he brought me a present?" I wondered. "Hello, Junie Moon," he said. I did my best not to stare at the hole smack in the middle of his forehead. I didn't want to be rude. All the same, I found that my eye kept being drawn back to that little red cavity, as neatly delineated as the rosebuds embroidered on the antimacassars in the sitting room. Vaguely, and without being able to articulate my suspicions, I sensed that something was not quite right. I didn't know what. How could I? After all, no one had ever told me he was dead. Junie Moon. He spoke the name as if he was tasting something delicate on his tongue. "There are things you need to know, Junie Moon." So he was really speaking to me. Here was another cause for astonishment. No one had ever called me Junie Moon before. Granny, who was not given to endearments, always called me Juanita. And at school, where the teachers insist on using surnames for both boys and girls, I was Delgardi. Except in the playground, where I was the recipient of the taunting nickname of Gardy Lou, and excluded from skipping games. "I like coffee, I like tea, I don't want Gardy Lou in with me." I liked the idea of being called Junie Moon. Somehow the name reminded me of the dance band music I sometimes heard on the old crackly bush wireless that Dimpfner, our home help, used to switch on when Granny was out. Victor Sylvester, "Music While You Work." All the fun in our house went on when Granny was out. I looked up at my father and opened my mouth, but before I could speak, he held up his hand, warning me to stay silent. "I don't have much time," he told me, "and I've forgotten some of what I meant to say. Don't talk, Junie Moon, or it'll all go out of me head." This was faintly disappointing. There were so many things I wanted to ask him. Where had he been for the past 7 years? Had he seen my mother lately? Why was he hovering above the ground? Why couldn't he stay? "Listen, Junie Moon." His voice was soft, the accent redolent, as I now know, of South London. "I don't much care for the way your granny's bringing you up. She tells you lies to make you behave. All the things, she tells you are completely untrue. A ball won't attack you just because you're wearing something red. Eating orange pith won't make you ill. Touching eggshells don't cause warts. Picking dandelions won't make you wet the bed. And when Granny Delgardi claims to be on intimate speaking terms with Catherine, Tsarina of all the Russias, she's just showing herself up as a vain, deceitful old woman." This was a shocking revelation. I had recently begun to suspect that Granny Delgardi had been using a number of old wives' tales to intimidate me, but I did not expect to hear my father cast doubt on her integrity as a medium. Granny Delgardy always commanded such a loyal audience at the Salutation Hall in Havelock Street. I'd been taken to my first seance when I was six, and I'd seen the way Aggie Simpson, a woman in her 50s, who wore her greying hair in a chignon and kept a bottle of scotch in her handbag, summoned the departed by playing "She'll Be Crumming Round the Mountain When She Comes" on the harmonium. Granny would sit in the big plush chair on the podium, her head lowered in anticipation. The lights would dim. Then Granny Delgardy would speak, her voice dropping a few registers and becoming mysteriously croaky, even guttural. "It is the Tsarina," she would gasp. "She is leading others by the hand. Loved ones, they are coming forward to greet you." I had a picture in my mind of the Tsarina coming round the mountain. The mountain, I thought, would look like the one on the Toblerone packet, a chocolate bar known only to me from sweet shop windows, confectionery having been banned from the house. Coming to a distinct point, snow clad at the summit, and there would be a path spiralling down, going round and round the mountain, and it was on this path that the Tsarina, who I imagined as a tall, imposing woman with a prominent chest like that of Mrs. Maloney, who served on the cheese counter in Sainsbury's, would appear. "I have to go now, Junie Moon." My father kissed his fingertips and flattening his hands towards me, blew his blessing in my direction. "You be a good girl now and remember what I've told you." I nodded. "Oh, and by the way," he winked at me knowingly, "next time your granny mentions the Empress of Russia, ask her to get Catherine the Great to explain what really happened with that horse." I opened my mouth to ask, "What horse?" But he shook his head at me, sadly. "That'll rattle her cage," he added. Then he was gone, and I might have doubted that I'd ever seen him at all, had it not been for the heady, masculine scent of bay rum hair oil that he left behind him. It lingered by the pear tree for days, although I had the feeling I was the only person who noticed. It was typical of Granny Delgardy to insist on calling that ramshackle end of the garden the orchard. Troubled by the stink from the gasworks and full of rotting brown medlars, the only fruit that grew there in spiteful abundance, it was an unsatisfactory place. There were only two other trees, one that produced fewer than six pears a year, and one where the apples were attacked by wasps even before they had left the branch. Dimfner would gather up the squashy harvest regularly, despite the fact that none of this fruit was remotely edible, especially not in Granny's bitter tasting chutney. The visitors would surreptitiously scrape to the edge of their plates, as did Mr. Bolsover, the visiting medium, the following evening when he came for supper. "When the spirits come to us, they do so and speak in riddles and platitudes." Mr. Bolsover wiped his mouth on the starch linen napkin and laid down his knife and fork. "It is our mission to act as interpreters," he added, suppressing a belch. "Exactly so," Granny Delgardy nodded. I was sitting on a footstool by the piano, pretending to be absorbed in my book, Rebecca of the Remove, an old foxed volume with stiff grey pasteboard covers that had belonged to my mother. I guessed that Granny Delgardy was trying to impress Mr. Bolsover, whom she seemed to hold in high esteem, despite his paunch and the shiny patches on the elbows of his jacket and the fact that he stank of whiskey. She was decked out in her best dark green velvet dress and black fringed shawl, and had put an ornamental diamante-studded comb in her thick grey hair. Dimfner had been instructed to bring out the best china, and a whole ham had been boiled. It was going to be a gala night at the Salutation Hall. Mr. Bolsover had travelled all the way down from Manchester to lead the gathering. I was still not certain whether I was invited, although I was absolutely sure I didn't want to go. It was January the 25th, 1954, my seventh birthday, although there were no bright, cheerful cards ranged along the mantelpiece for me. Granny Delgardy disapproved of birthdays, and my birth, as I'd overheard her reminding Dimfner during a chutney boiling session in the back kitchen, had been nothing to celebrate. She made her mother suffer, such a great lump of a baby, far too big from the start. The pipes were frozen, so we had no hot water. She couldn't have chosen a worse time to be born. 1947, the coldest winter since 1814. The doctor's car was stuck in a snowdrift, so he didn't get here until it was all over. And that no good father of hers, where was he? The only merciful thing was it wasn't a stillbirth. The back garden was so frozen we'd never have got the spade into the ground. The blessed saints and Mary, Mother of God! In her agitation, Dinkner had seized a scouring pad and began scrubbing furiously at a burned-on mess at the base of the big, double-handed jam pan. Mrs. Durgardi, you can't be saying what I think you're saying. As if the poor child could choose the day of her delivery. I knew that Dinkner would pay for that outburst, and so she did. The very next time she asked for a rise in her wages, Granny retaliated by lowering them by sixpence. "Has your granddaughter inherited your talent?" Mr. Bolsover asked, casting a dubious glance in my direction. "She has shown no sign of it," said Granny Delgardi. "She is an earthen child, I fear, not a single element of fire or air in her veins." I turned the page of my book, looking studiously at a colour print of a girl in an old-fashioned gym slip holding a hockey stick. "It's absolutely beastly of you, Jemima," the caption read, "to say you won't play this afternoon just because you want to sneak off to tea with Rupert." Good for Jemima, I thought. I'd do the same. Rebecca looked like an awful self-righteous bully. I could imagine Granny Delgardi looking like that when she was a girl. "I wonder," Mr. Bolsover ventured, "if you have a drop of brandy in the house to guard against the cold before we venture forth." "I'm afraid not, Mr. Bolsover." Granny Delgardi bared her yellowing teeth in what was supposed to be a smile. "This is a temperance house. It has been ever since my unfortunate daughter passed over." "Ah, commiserations," he nodded. "And that was how long ago, may I ask? How did it happen?" It occurred to me that if Mr. Bolsover was a medium, he shouldn't need to ask. Had he no vision of the moment when my mother died? I had. I could see my mother. She was slim and her dark hair was styled in a permanent wave, and she was wearing a clinging lemon silk dressing evening gown, and she was sprawled on the rug before the fireplace, one silver lame sandal still on her foot, the other on its side by the coal scuttle. She'd screamed, she'd fallen, something had dropped out of her hand, and there had been music playing and the scent of rose water. I didn't know how old I'd been at the time, or even if I'd actually witnessed that scene, but I was certain it had happened right here in this room. "It was a tragedy," Granny Delgardi spoke sharply, rather too sharply perhaps to such an important guest. "I blame that scoundrel, that cad. He broke her heart, deserting her. He went away without so much as leaving her a forwarding address. She should never have married him. But I do have one comfort. The Tsarina has assured me that my daughter is happy now that she is on the other side. She is better off without him, even in death." There was a crash as a sepia photograph of old Aberdeen fell off the wall and its ornately carved burntwood frame landed in the fireplace with an emphatic splintering of glass. I just managed not to laugh out loud. I had absolutely no doubt at all why that picture had fallen, and whose unquiet spirit had tipped it from its hook. Sucking in my cheeks and taking a deep breath, I quickly turned over the next page of Rebecca of the Remove. "Juanita, how many times have I told you to sit still?" Granny Delgardi glared at me. "And if you continue to read in that light, expect to be blind before you are 20. "It was nothing to do with the child," said Mr. Bolsover smoothly. "The string at the back of the picture must have been frayed, and gravity has simply done its worst." Granny Delgardi pulled the tasseled cord for Dinkner to come and clear up the mess. I didn't realise it then, but this must have been one of the last homes in London where it was possible to summon a maid in this way. Not that Dinkner would have described herself in those terms, even though she did live in. I was, however, aware that the house was ugly and old-fashioned, so tall and narrow, with dark staircases and creaking doors and chocolate brown paint below the dado rails and tea-coloured wallpaper above. All the furniture was ancient and heavy. the table in this room covered by a thick chenille cloth, and the carpet smelling of dead mice. I was sure that no one else in my class lived in a house like this. Granny, I looked at her with what I intended to be an innocent expression, can I ask you a question? If it is a sensible one. Granny was clearly treating me with more indulgence than normal to impress Mr. Bolsover. Well, I was wondering, why doesn't the Tsarina talk to you in Russian? Catherine the Great was a Russian, wasn't she? So why doesn't she talk to you? Why does she talk to you in English? Granny Delgardi frowned at me. I was sure that not only had she no answer for this, she was also trying to decide whether I was being deliberately provocative. When the spirits pass over, Mr. Bolsover smiled at me, such considerations become irrelevant. That is, they are not important. By which I mean, they do not apply. I see. I closed my book and nodded at Granny. So you can ask the Tsarina any question you like and she'll understand? Naturally. Then could you ask her what really happened with that horse? Horse? What on earth are you talking about, Juanita? With an impatient jerk, Granny Delgardi pulled the cord again for Dimphna, a futile action as I knew, having seen our home help slip out through the back gate half an hour ago on her way to see the Glenn Miller story at the Odeon. Mr. Bolsover cleared his throat and leaned across the table, lowering his voice. I'm afraid your granddaughter is alluding to a scurrilous rumour concerning the death of Catherine the Great, he murmured. The Lord knows how the child has heard the story. I can't think what story you mean. Granny Delgardi's lips tightened. I wouldn't dream of repeating it, said Mr. Bolsover, not in mixed company. I'm afraid I must ask you to do so. Granny Delgardi tapped her finger impatiently. If the girl has learned an improper story, I need to know. Very well. With a salacious glint in his eye, Mr. Bolsover cupped his hand and whispered a few words into her ear. Granny Delgardi let out a snort of disgust and stood up so quickly that she knocked over the pink-fringed standard lamp. Then she informed me that as a punishment, I would not be coming to the salutation hall tonight, and I was to go out into the garden without my coat and stay out there until I was allowed to come in. It was freezing outside with sleet falling, and I felt my fingertips tingling with the cold the moment I stepped out. My favourite part of the garden was between the wall and the bramble bush, just beyond the pear tree in the so-called orchard. This had provided me with a hiding place, and tonight I crawled in and wrapped my arms around me, pulling the sleeves of my scratchy old woolen cardigan down over my hands for warmth. After a while, I looked up and noticed several lush, ripe blackberries growing against the prickly leaves. I didn't realise there was something odd, that there shouldn't be any fruit here in January, nor did I worry about Granny Delgardi's warning that small insects which could make my tongue swell lurked in unwashed brambles. I started picking the fruit, cramming them into my mouth, letting the juice trickle down my throat. The berries had a strange flavour, sweet at first, but with an aftertaste which reminded me of the time I had grazed my knee badly in the playground and had put the wound to my mouth in order to suck out the grit. Blood, I thought, frowning. Happy birthday, Judy Moon, the voice said, close to my ear, and I felt warm and comforted. And that, of course, was only the beginning. Well, take that with you.